House will come to order. In accordance with the uniform rules, during a joint session, the President of the Senate presides. So at this time, I'll turn the gavel over to the President of the Senate, Senator Katula.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Joint session, please come to order.
We're here to hear the Honorable Governor J. Hammond state message. Senator Rohde, would you waive the roll call of the Senate?
Mr. President, I move to ask unanimous consent that the roll call of the Senate be waived and all members of the Senate be shown as present.
Out of Jackson, so ordered. Representative Halpern.
Speaker, I move to ask unanimous consent that the roll call of the House be waived and all members of the House be shown as present.
So ordered. I wish to appoint an escort for the governor. I'll appoint Senator Ziegler and Representative Hogan to escort the governor to the chamber.
That is a likely chair.
Mr. Speaker, members of the legislature, and fellow Alaskans. Absent either divine or legislative intervention, this hopefully is the 11th and last time I'm either privileged or obliged to address you in joint session on the condition of this state. Since I may not again captivate so large and pertinent an audience, I'd like to take some license and devote a portion of my valedictory to where we were, where we are, and where I hope we're going. Since I'm the first governor to address you who cannot succeed himself, if I blur pride with penance, please indulge me in the knowledge that this is not just another campaign kickoff. 7 years ago, at my inauguration, I asked all Alaskans to help me shape a pathway to our future comprised of stepping stones, not stumbling blocks. In that construction effort, I suspect at times not only my fingers, but my credibility has been bruised. While perhaps bashed fingers can be blamed on ineptitude in wielding the hammer, our credibility was crushed as much by those asserting we would malevolently manipulate the chisel. Some pandered to your fears by ascribing to us wondrously ingenious motivations which, though flattering, I confess were far beyond my wit to conjure up. Perhaps most wildly imaginative was the assertion that I calculatedly cultivated opposition from those deemed least credible by the public in hope that when they were on target, no one would ever notice. If that be the case, credit's owed less to wisdom than dumb luck. Since beyond this year, I'm constrained by law, if not common sense, from either self-inflicted or involuntary bashing, we can perhaps view a bit more objectively both accomplishments and failures. To do so requires we examine not only what has in fact transpired, but as well some fears which proved unfounded. I'm sure you remember most of them. Take zero growth. Because we'd cautioned that some growth could be malevolent, certain special interests which prosper from any growth, whether healthy or malignant, charged we were opposed to even growth which met those three criteria for health. Is it environmentally sound? Can it pay its own way? And do the people want it? These interests used their own hammers to chisel a one-dimensional image of an administration unconcerned with the well-being of either management or labor. Subsequently, of course, the acid rain of evidence corroded the credibility of those heavy-handed artisans and crumbled that marble-headed image. Growth of virtually every sort continues to outstrip that of other states and every previous administration. Whether you conclude it is in spite of or because of this administration's policies is really not the point. The facts are these. Alaskans holding jobs last winter grew in number by 41,000 over the first winter of this administration. Housing grew by 79%, almost 50% faster than population. Home and business loans grew from about $150 million in 1975 to over $2.2 billion in 1982. Our fisheries harvest grew above each preceding year, save one, fivefold during this administration. Alaska's per capita income led the nation every year, reportedly growing 18% last year alone, well ahead of inflation and 70% faster than the national average. State land conveyance grew by 334,132 acres the past 7 years compared to a total of but 284,476 acres the prior 16 years since statehood. In 1981 alone, 188,000 acres were put up for sale. Agricultural production grew 400%. Tourism grew from 285,000 visitors in 1975 to 630,000 last year. Mineral production grew by over 200%, 400% for gold, sand, and gravel. Mineral claims on lands grew, state lands grew from 11,383 to 23,400. Rural sewer and water projects grew by more than 400%. Transportation projects grew by some 500, totaling over $650 million in awarded contracts. Education's budget, excluding the university, grew from $183 million in 1975 to $551 million in 1981, nearly a third of the entire operating budget. The university's operating budget grew fourfold. State aid to municipalities grew 700% from $21.5 million in 1975 to $146.4 million last year, though population grew by only about 3% per year. Naturally, all this growth has not been without cost. Our operational budget grew from $651 million in 1975 to $1.9 billion last year, despite a $344 million growth in vetoes of would-be government served spending. The number of state employees grew 10.2% from 14,689 to 16,373, while municipal employees grew another 34% from 14,557 to 22,094. Facts demonstrate that during this administration, growth, some good, some bad, has been unprecedented. Much growth was prompted because Alaska has done more than any other state to foster business and personal income growth through increased government spending, tax reduction, subsidized loans and services, and as a result, payroll employments have grown, building permits are up and rising, sales have grown, construction monies are hitting the streets in such volumes that Alaskan-based contractors can't handle it all. And what's more, growth and development in the early 80s is projected to be five times greater than from 1975 to 1980. Is it any wonder that those who asserted that this administration would somehow nurture zero growth have lost just a tad of credibility? Among other fears which proved unfounded were predictions by some union bosses that we had no concern for working people and would incur even higher unemployment. Yet records show our Department of Labor's successful annual job placements grew from 24,945 in 1975 to 33,725 last year. Now, hopefully, in being proven wrong, some are less chagrined than pleased that Alaska, for the first time, has not the nation's highest unemployment. just as I hope they're pleased, they erred in predicting that this administration would institute a catalog of alleged horrors such as the right-to-work law and other union-busting tactics. And remember those Republican officials who predicted my reapportionment board appointees would shortchange the grand old party. They've not been heard from since they've seen the plan for which the Democrats now sue us. Or remember those disciples of Proposition 13 who argued that to cut government growth, we should repeal our income tax. Since repealed, state spending has been cut all right, cut loose to soar into the stratosphere. Or remember those who charged we were preaching gloom and doom by urging we put some oil wealth in a permanent fund against the day our income might be insufficient to cover ongoing costs of government. These critics ridiculed those concerns, asserting that such vast pools of oil lay untapped, that we should worry only how our next windfall should be spent. Now, however, at long last, unstable oil prices and the critics' own projection graphs have triggered their alarms. Whether we run out of sufficient oil wealth because of declining income or excessive spending yields precisely the same result. Living has exceeded means. To live within our means, you can't preach that one should be unconcerned for reducing means, whether it be through tax repeal or declining oil wealth, and expect the public you've deluded to lessen pressure on the legislature for gratification of their every want. Government spending has increased almost unbridled because of public presumptions and demands boosted by those who conditioned the public to believe concerns for going broke should be ignored as nothing more than gloom or doom. Hopefully their newfound religion proves not too little nor too late. Remember how my appointees to the White House Conference on Families were predicted by opponents of the conference to likely devastate traditional family structures, and by proponents as inclined to stifle the most important feminist advancement since woman suffrage. Could any of you now tell me which ones were right or wrong? Or remember those decrying my prediction that the oil line might be delayed 1 year and cost not three, but perhaps $10 billion. I no longer make such pronouncements lightly, since that one created a blizzard of barbed editorials, a stock market plunge, and frantic reassurance from pipeline sponsors that the $3 billion cost was firm. Several billion plus 1 year later, my prediction regrettably proved pretty accurate. Or remember those asserting Alaskan oil taxes would drive industry away. Instead, activity increased. Currently, Alaskan wells are pumping an average of 250 times faster than those of any other state, depleting our known reserves by 1% every 60 days. As a result, for the first time, Alaska now sends $2 back to Washington for each dollar we receive. Yet ironically, at the very time Alaska has emerged as an economic boon to the entire nation, rather than as before a tax burden on its back, we are criticized by editors from other states as prospering at their expense. Almost daily, we're shown publications on whose editorial pages inaccuracy struggles with ignorance for supremacy. Small wonder polls show only 35% of what the people read is now believed. Now, it can be argued that such distortions are simply politics or journalistic license, and that no one takes them seriously. Certainly, both at times deal more with perception than reality. Thus, as a politician, I'd like to play a bit of politics myself and convince the public that I should get all credit for that which they approve, and you should get all blame for that which they abhor. Not only would I never get away with it, but there are some things of which the public probably approves, for which I neither deserve nor want any credit whatsoever. But rather than try to underscore such points by using cold statistics, I'd like to share some letters received from those most affected by what we have and have not done. These far better tell the story. Take this verbatim letter from a major tour executive. Dear Governor Hammond, your administration has been accused of being anti-business. However, from my perspective in the visitor industry, that accusation could not be further from the truth. You have supported the tourism industry more than the collective efforts of all previous administrations. Or this letter from one who got a piece of land. I'm proud of your administration's 150 percentile improvement since 1975 and land disposal over all previous administrations since statehood, or from one of you who wrote, "To do a good job as governor, you have to make all interest groups upset. I've been critical, but I have utmost respect and believe you're fair." Well, certainly it seems that I've balanced my offense to special interest groups. At least none assert they've been shortchanged when it comes to perceived effrontery from this administration. Proof was provided by an administration member who was recently required to present an issue before a mixed group of miners and environmentalists. He advised me that he got a surprisingly harmonious response for such a disparate group. The environmentalists demanded his resignation, while the miners were perfectly willing to forego the resignation and go straight to the hanging. Now, while certainly we've been able to outrage or confuse all factions on our own, at times we're given outside help. Take this letter from a native corporate leader. Quote, "An interview quoted me as saying that I did not agree with your anti-business, posy-sniffing approach to the business community. What I really said was I did not agree with the idea generally prevalent in the Alaskan business community that you were a posy sniffer and anti-business," unquote. Now, you've got to admit there is a subtle difference. One thing for which I'd just as soon get little credit, frankly, is the alarming growth of subsidized state loans. The inequities and horrendous hidden costs to all Alaskans of providing enormous dividends to a favored few would, if understood by all Alaskans, give not only Ron and Penny heartburn. From one Alaskan businessman who does understand comes this comment. "Does not make prudent sense to pay out 12% interest for AHFC bond money and then charge only 9% on return. No prudent business can long last that way. After all, it's a direct subsidy to real estate and building trades. The high cost of housing will never come down until housing interest rates are more realistic," unquote. If he thinks that's imprudent business, he should see some of our other 37 state-subsidized loan programs. Of course, some letters are less concerned with the temporal or mundane and deal with more profound considerations. Take this exact quotation. "I only hope the war of Armageddon between man, Iran, and women, Tehran, gets sweated out in love and that all get tetanus boosters. And if war develops without understanding, we will all find one another in the end. Keep down the economy and raise welfare. Ban smokers," unquote. Still trying to figure out if he supported me or Wally. On the other hand, I have no trouble whatsoever figuring out where this fellow's coming from. "Hammond, you're a posy-sniffing swine who doesn't believe in growth, private land ownership, tax relief, jobs for Alaskans, or low-interest loans." I cite that letter not only to acknowledge that, as you may suspect, not all of our correspondence is supportive, but as well it's true, I do have some problems with those issues. I'll be discussing these concerns, however, in my budget message. Suffice to say now, most of those concerns could be alleviated only if a spending limitation passes. Now, while the proposed spending limitation is far more restrictive than the status quo, some are concerned about how it treats capital projects and permanent fund contributions. I share those concerns, though not to the degree I did before I tried it on for size. Critics who believe the limitation is too loose should support the limitation codicil I'll propose for placement on the ballot. This would provide that no more than half the funds available above the ceiling could be appropriated for voter-approved capital projects. The other half would go on the ballot as increased contributions to the permanent fund. Moreover, appropriations for capital projects rejected by the voters would automatically go into that fund. Now, to those who have voiced criticism that the current limitation is too loose, here's your chance to put your mouths where our money is. Last year, key legislators asserted they would work with me to remedy some prime concerns with hydro bills. In stating why I would not sign them into law, I cited these concerns and my intent to draw on those commitments. One key factor, which I said must be included to avoid veto, was at least some modest equity return. While agreed to last year by most parties, the bills failed to require this. Thus, while I could have exercised my veto in full compliance with our mutual understanding, to do so would have deferred some good projects and incurred added costs. Moreover, the restructuring of the Alaska Power Authority was deemed a necessary factor which otherwise was also lost. Despite enormous reductions in anticipated revenue and quantum leaps in anticipated project costs, there's no reason we cannot yet provide great assistance to viable hydro projects. While I'll be proposing multi-millions for such projects, final acceptance of them will depend on passage of remedial legislation. The arguments that people should not have to borrow their own money from the state for hydro projects persuades me only when all people get similar benefits or we meet the needs of those whose needs are less well met than others. If it be our conclusion that we are to provide public power subsidies, that all the public should be favorably affected, the legislation I'll propose would more equitably address that issue. Since to date there's been no decision from the court regarding the permanent fund dividend program, I've prepared legislation which provides an alternative to be triggered only by an adverse ruling. Meanwhile, should the court rule wisely, checks will be mailed out shortly. When it was suggested by some wag that I should sign those checks, I told them that to do so would be presumptive, unseemly, tacky, ill-received, and outrageous. So I went ahead and did it. Much is heard these days about Alaskanizing the permanent fund. Nothing would more Alaskanize it than if every Alaskan were to receive a dividend which rose or fell, dependent upon the size and prudent investment of the fund. Fund trustees now administer investments of such magnitude that when they speak, E.F. Hutton listens. To improve performance, they propose some changes in the statute. These are compiled into a bill for your consideration. I agree that if the fund is to keep pace with inflation, some equity ownership must be acquired, and at the very least, one half its earnings flow back into the fund. While still in office, I'd like to see passage of a drug bill similar to the one we and the Senate have endorsed. Epidemic drug abuse, including alcohol, makes it evident that what we're doing or not doing isn't working. I don't know how effective the proposed drug bill will prove to be, but we all know how ineffective the status quo has proven. When legislation is endorsed by those who know far more about these matters than I confess do I, it seems that common sense and public indignation warrant action if we care at all. Again, perception may be as important as reality. If you can't support it, put it up for public vote. Frequently I'm asked, what was achieved during this administration? Again, while I'd like to take full credit for at least some of them, none occurred without joint effort and much more cooperation than screaming headlines give us credit for. I suspect that were we party to them or but reluctant protesters, these are the most memorable occurrences taking place while most of you have been in office. Creation of the permanent fund, efforts to more equitably privatize a portion of the public's wealth through dividends, for proposing a limitation on state spending, for expanding agriculture, for advances in fisheries enhancement, for unprecedented tax reduction, for multi-millions in low-interest loans, for vast expansion of educational opportunities to all, for providing telecommunications to virtually all Alaskans, for greatly increased benefits to old-timers, for land dispersal exceeding all prior administrations put together, for vast increases in municipal assistance, for granting far greater public say in how their money is expended, for providing means of resolving the capital move impasse, for drafting the 7 consensus points to be pressed for in D2 legislation, for an economy in which many business people assert they've never done better, for an unemployment rate for the first time beneath the nation's highest, for a period in which the greatest increase in female and minority in hiring has occurred, for greater attention and financial support for alcohol and drug abuse programs, and for tougher laws dealing with offenders, for an awareness that some kinds of growth may bring costs exceeding benefits, and a willingness to exercise that awareness through such things as repurchase of the Kachemak Bay oil leases and successful challenge to some federal leasing on our outer continental shelf, for a cabinet and staff which even some members of previous administrations have told me is the best collective crew since statehood. And finally, for the reluctant acknowledgments from some of our severest critics that we seem to be reasonably honest. Of course, for almost none of the above can this administration take full blame or credit. Moreover, only time will tell which achievements warrant one and not the other. I predict that Times assessment will take on far greater luster if both the dividend and spending limits are in place. One achievement I'd like to see us all get credit for is limiting legislative session length. A public advisory vote has overwhelmingly expressed support. My proposal would limit sessions to 90 days. However, extensions of 15 days could be called within 3 legislative days. Items to be considered must be approved by a majority of each House and the governor. Some assert that this would play into special interest hands by making it easier for them to kill crucial legislation. However, conversely, it's also less likely special interests can get lousy legislation passed within the shorter time frame. And I suspect the public will agree that the hazards of legislation passed are far greater than those of legislation which never sees the light of day. No doubt, some will feel that 90 days is far too short and that you need 120. However, under my proposal, 90 days is by no means a limit absolute. It is but a target date for which to shoot. If crucial reasons obligate more time, it can be provided. Stretch out that target date by yet another month, and it grows indistinct and far less effective. Moreover, with a spending limit, it should be much easier to structure budgets. With no limit, the budget process is drawn out and enormously complex, a potpourri of politics and personalities. Certainly, preparation of ingredients for any stew could be more readily accomplished if one first knows the size of the restraining pot. The spending limit, by defining its dimensions, should lead to shorter sessions. Couple that with the facts that formula programs now automatically dictate about half the budget, plus the large growth in both legislative staff and interim committees, and it would seem that the legislative in-session burden would be substantially reduced. Finally, should you still feel 90 days is too restrictive, want to try it on for size this session. Shoot for that target date and then permit only items deemed crucial by the majority to be brought up beyond it. As another safeguard, you could provide for voter re-endorsement or rejection in 1986. Additionally, I urge you to submit to the voters a proposal to increase contributions to the permanent fund. Currently, but 1/10 of our oil wealth goes into the fund. By contributing a comparable percentage of the severance tax, not simply royalties, this would almost double, but still be far less than the public's perception that about 1/2 of our oil wealth goes into the fund. Some years ago, I advised the legislature that unless they had a 2/3 vote for veto override, please don't put upon my desk any bills further liberalizing such things as gambling, drug abuse, prostitution, or abortion. These are basic moral issues which best are changed by public vote. Subsequently, none of the then pending legislation surfaced. Now, however, I'm advised there will be an effort to liberalize so-called charitable gambling. In the past, such efforts were vetoed by Governor Egan on advice of legal counsel that it would, quote, compound enforcement costs and problems, plus pave the way for professional gambling and its attendant unsavory consequences, unquote. I quite agree. Accordingly, let me reiterate that either you should place this issue up for public vote or have at least 2/3 support before bringing up the matter. In that regard, I propose we take advantage of this election year by placing on the ballot a slate of advisory questions for which there are not now clear collective public viewpoints. I yet hope that while in office, most issues which divide Alaskans may be healed. For example, in drawing up the 7 D2 consensus points, I'd hope to give some unity and focus to our efforts in securing an Alaska Lands Bill, which would provide both rational resource development and adequate environmental safeguard. That the final product please no one in its entirety suggests that it may yet approach those goals. Regardless of that bill's deficiencies, few can deny the aggravation level on that issue has dropped several notches. Similarly, when I took office, the state was angrily divided over where the capital should be. The ballot question presented to you last year will, to the best degree possible, settle this issue. Meanwhile, that issue too has cooled. One explosive issue yet remains. This issue is subsistence. Until recently, but a time bomb ticking in the wings, it has now rolled to center stage. Its potential for shattering divisiveness is evident. If we're to defuse it, there must be broader understanding of some basic facts. The Native Claims Settlement Act was, of course, the price at the time willingly accepted in return for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline by some who now decry that act. An appendage of that act was the subsistence issue. Most Alaska Natives believe subsistence crucial to their identity and way of life. Current statutes dealing with subsistence are viewed by them as almost sacred writ, which should not be changed. Conversely, many urban sportsmen view subsistence statutes as unnecessary and blatantly discriminatory. The problem is both are partly right and partly wrong. Had the legislature never passed the current law, I believe a reasonable subsistence preference could have been provided, which most Alaskans would accept as fair. However, by including preference for ill-defined customary and traditional usage, instead of only need, opponents of the statute felt they were given a long, sharp-bladed shaft. Now they've reversed that blade and would use it heavy-handedly to pin a subsistence law repealer on the ballot, which, if passed, ironically could do more injury to them than those they view as their opponents. I can understand why the legislature will not likely tinker with this issue. After all, just like D2, it's a sure loser if you come down the arena anywhere between the two warring factions. And I'm convinced that's where most would be if they but knew the facts. I believe this issue could be diffused by amending the subsistence statute to grant preference only where resources were insufficient to meet the quantifiable needs of those truly most dependent. Imperfect yardstick though it is, income level may be the best and most acceptable need measure. Customary and traditional usage, on the other hand, defies definition, much less measure. For example, should I, hopefully living in the bush on a fat retirement, be granted special subsistence privileges by simple virtue of area residency, while, say, an Anchorage native with but one-tenth my income is disqualified? Custom and tradition language might have it so, but equity and common sense do not. There simply is no proper yardstick by which to measure traditional and customary use. If you have no clear markers on a yardstick, it should be discarded. If you won't amend existing law to provide some better means of measure, at least make sure that your constituents are well aware that referendum language does much more than simply repeal the state's subsistence law. It would as well prohibit any accountable or acceptable need factor in determining subsistence preference, to say nothing of inviting the federal government to manage our fish and game on certain of their lands. As one who remembers well the statehood battle largely premised on the charge that we could better manage our affairs than could the federal government, I cannot believe that most Alaskans would support return to such splintered management, which can only lead to greater division and confusion. While in my view, the native err in not supporting some diffusing amendments to the subsistence laws, that error pales in contrast to the probable disservice rendered all Alaskans if the referendum passes. These things had best be clearly understood by your constituents before they cast their votes, or it may come back to haunt you. In closing, a few words of sincere appreciation. I must admit my first few months as governor were not filled with jubilation. I felt not only unduly overworked, but also unduly worked over. I counted the days until I could return to my old life, and some of you no doubt counted with me. What I liked least were demands for immediate selection from two or more alternatives, which to me were often garbed in non-distinctive shades of gray. Each, however, were passionately endorsed by partisans who felt their option festooned in all the colors of the rainbow. Frequently, those unsuccessful in lobbying their cause were like some thwarted swains, pathetic or vindictive. From them, adverse decisions prompted charges of venality, corruption, personal gain, or at best, stupidity. And these came from our friends. Opponents were even less approving. Daily, we in government, of course, are faced with decisions both mundane and momentous. And as some unknown author once said, on the plains of hesitation bleached the bones of countless millions, who at the dawn of victory sat down to rest and in resting died. While comparatively, present times here in Alaska might seem very good, Don't sit back in presumption they'll go on forever without asking rude questions or sifting healthy from unhealthy growth. If I've done nothing more, I hope I've stuck too many needles in the cushions of those inclined to do so. Over time, some pointed messages have gotten through, and most of what I'd hoped to do has been accomplished or set in motion. For that, I have all of you to thank. Yours has been an awesome job. You shoulder burdens unimagined by most of your critics. Together, we've come through the most tumultuous years in this state's history and have come through them pretty well. Those of us who've come to know you are well aware that most politicians really want to do what's right, sometimes against enormous pressures to do wrong, and often with a blurring of any clear distinction. If politicians have one common bond, it is desire to be loved. In courting the electorate, time will judge whether love affairs were sacred or profane. Meanwhile, sometimes we wonder why our critics try so hard to make us hate them. In my case, they have not succeeded. Not only have critics prompted warranted soul-searching, but at times whimsical diversion. For example, who can really hate a fellow who can come up with such a fulsome phrase as posy-sniffing swine? However, to appreciate when one is standing on a mountaintop, he must also traverse some valleys. And providing pitfalls and impediments, one's critics assure that such will be the case. I thank them for it, not in spite of, but because of them, do I consider myself among the luckiest of men, boosted to more than his share of appreciated mountaintops. I thank both those who supported and those who have merely suffered my presence in this office. Special gratitude to those who, through their prayers or presence, have sustained my family and administration. While admittedly the first few years were less than totally enchanting, in retrospect, I've enjoyed every one of them. Once aware that grief enriches glory, Alaskans have been wondrous kind, forgiving, indulgent, and supportive. That's right, supportive. While all recall my razor-thin vote margins, in the last election, you gave me more than twice the margin granted any other governor. So what if we had to slice the pie four ways to do it? Some ask if I will run again, perhaps for Congress. Not only are we well represented there already, but anything compelling my departure from Alaska, I view as a step backward off that mountaintop shared by all those privileged to live up here. Besides, I agree with Artemus Ward, who once said, "The prevailing weakness of most public men is to slop over. George Washington never slopped over." After some 34 years in governmental service, Jay Hammond's coming perilously close to slopping over. Knowing when to quit is one Washingtonian attribute we'd all do well to emulate. My first inaugural address, I said that I would do my best to fashion of government a table in the round at which all Alaskans could sit and sup as co-equals. You've permitted me to undertake that task. I regret that carpentry is not yet complete. If at times I've tried to elbow aside some already feeding sumptuously, make room for those otherwise confined to but scraps which fall upon the floor, I make no apology whatsoever. I apologize only if I have failed or disappointed you, and to those I may have injured by unthoughtful word or deed. My regrets for having done so are exceeded only by my appreciation of the chance you granted me to come to better know and perhaps serve this state and all its people. For that, I'm in your debt forever.